Hello, this is Best Practice. I'm Richard Adey. Welcome to the show. Is there someone in your workplace who pokes fun at what's going on? This could be you, or it could be someone you think of as a bit of an outsider. But despite the sense of distance, the anti-establishment veneer, it turns out they really do have the best interests of the firm at heart. This isn't coming from me, just to save confusion. It's coming from a couple of researchers named Richard. Professor Richard Baddams at the Macquarie Graduate School of Management, Richard Claydens, a lecturer at APIC, the Asia Pacific International College. The two Richards have studied these outsiders, and together they've established a consultancy, the Ironic Manager. So, Richard Clayden, what's the idea behind it?
The idea behind it is looking at people in organisations that are making a difference in this in-between space between resistance and sort of managerial control. It came out of a bunch of research in Silicon Valley in the 1980s, 1990s, and then Richard Baddam researched BHP and found very similar characteristics as the researchers in Silicon Valley found about these guys that they characterized as ironic, who were poking a little bit of fun at the organizational expectations, but doing very good work at the same time. So Richard had a huge amount of data, didn't necessarily agree with how the Americans were treating it. This is that they were just poking fun and they weren't very serious and they were playing games. And then got me involved in the project as a PhD student to try and work out if there was more to this sort of ironic fun-making than the American model had.
So we're talking about people who were sort of sarcastic, mocking work. Is that what we're thinking? Is that what you're talking about?
It's a funny thing. And when you're in an organization, you kind of live in two worlds. You live in the formal world of everything's rational and efficient and it's all working out. And then you go backstage into the coffee bars and it's all about the gossip and the emotions and whatever. And it's like our organizations are schizophrenic. You're one person in a formal meeting, you're another person outside. And yet we're actually finding that people who are really effective and they're resilient and engaging are people who actually float between the two. They acknowledge in public that there's a bit of bullshit going on. In private, they're actually trying to go for the good of the institution as well.
So they can be taking the piss.
They can be taking the piss, but taking the piss can come out of a position of weakness. You know, your weapons of the weak is what some people talked about irony. It's like you use cynicism and sarcasm because you're a Dilbert figure on the outside and you have no control. But then you also have somebody like, say, a Richard Branson mocking himself, Jamie Oliver mocking himself, and John Stewart mocking themselves but also trying to get something done. And that was what I liked. It was finding more groups of people around the world who are kind of pursuing institutional objectives, trying to get things done, but actually also realizing that they may not make it. They're a bit of an idiot themselves and having a lightness of being.
Okay, so how does classical management thinking, if I could put it that way, compare with the ironic manager approach?
If you take classical management thinking to be, let's work out the best, most rational way to do it, here's your toolbox, here's your set of techniques. And despite having business schools having changed, they still tend to teach toolboxes, right way, methods. If, however, you actually shift your view of an organization's about people making sense of the world, it's about power, it's about politics, it's about stories, then irony is actually, it's a particular kind of genre, really, in a way. It's like realizing that you're inside and outside your story, that your story is partly made up, that you can actually reshape it, that you're making yourself out to be a hero, but actually maybe you're the devil. It's standing outside it. So if we see organizations, and this is happening more and more now in latest academic research, organizations are about people making sense of the world and telling stories. To actually be able to stand outside that and say, if it is storied, if it is drama, if it's a performance, what's a good one? You know, how am I acting? Right. We know it's a bit of a fake, but we also know that it can be real.
I want to talk about how management should engage with these ironic people who may not be them, because people who mock and ridicule, I mean, I can remember being told, maybe as too smarmy a young journalist, that my attitude wasn't right. That is not an uncommon scenario, is it?
It's not. I think one of the things you have to recognise about irony is it's not just the mocking and the ridiculing. It's the perspective on what's going on versus what people think is going on. So quite often the management think this is what's happening. And the ironist in position says, no, actually this is going on and there's a difference, there's a gap and I'm living in this gap. You don't have to then mock the person. I think that's the difference between irony and sarcasm. As soon as you start mocking the person and saying, it's your fault, you're being sarcastic, you're tearing their flesh. And if you do that, then they're going to react quite viciously towards you. If you can somehow reveal the problem in the gap, the fact that what they think is happening isn't what is happening, and then you can do that without attacking the person.
It's the difference between how things actually work and the organisational chart that says how things actually
Absolutely.
Work.
Absolutely. I'll give you a perfect example of how it can happen. So one of the places that I was consulting to recently, they sort of said, well, how do we sort out the problems? Who you go into the floor, do some process consulting, work out what's going on, work out where the issues are. And I came back to the management team and I said, well, there are two people that I want to work with. And I told them who they were. And they said, well, she's cynical and he's lazy. And I said, well, yeah, but she's cynical because she's been trying to get things changed for a long time. No one's listened to her. So she had this nice ironic enthusiasm, but you've pushed her into a cynical space. He's lazy because he knows all the workarounds. He knows all the absurdities and he's doing that. But actually by listening to him seriously, you can start working out how you can improve your processes. So I want to work with them because they're the two that actually have the energy and the ideas. But you're not listening to them because you've pushed them into apathy and cynicism because you've not listened to them for so long.
There's an old army adage, I think, that if there's a new task, you get the laziest man to do it. He will work out the quickest and easiest way, and then you can get him to show everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of it, the people who are doing the quickest and easiest way, or the laziest way, they're the ones who really understand what is actually going on versus this management organizational chart of how you should behave. And by surfacing what they're talking about and repackaging it into something that management will listen to, you're beginning to close this gap. And by closing the gap, you're beginning to create some competitive advantage and some extra productivity and things. And that's why listening to them becomes important. But you've got to avoid the sarcastic mocking attack on the manager. It's still irony, but it's not sarcasm.
It's
there's a okay. fundamental difference.
Yeah, I'm getting it now. I realised where I was going wrong all those years ago too. Where should we be looking for it? Or is this in every level?
Interesting. It is at every level. If anybody thinks about the modern workplace, you realise that it's, while everybody's talking about innovation and change, I think we've become more conformist. Year after year, there's more 360 degrees feedback. You've got to be politically correct. You've got to fit in with the latest vision. I mean, 20 years ago, when people created the kind of visions they now have in organizations, they'd have laughed in their face. Now it's taken seriously. Because of that conformity, beneath the surface, there's a lot of resentment and rebellion. It's why all the Dilbert cartoons got spread everywhere, because it drives everything underground. Whereas to actually recognize what Harvard Business School has called the rebel talent, constructive nonconformity, is actually a really important thing to do. And so if you want to mobilize the kind of people that Richard was talking about that are on the shop floor and are actually being pushed into cynicism, you've got to actually try and capture their enthusiasm. You need to have leaders who can actually poke fun at themselves in order to communicate with the audience. And I think that it's important at all the levels.
So they need to have the self-knowledge and the sense of humour and be secure enough in their own expertise to be able to do that.
The self-knowledge is really interesting. When we coined the term ironic manager because it seemed so silly. You know, when people thought of managers, they didn't think of irony. When they thought of irony, they didn't think of managers. Mm. So we thought, let's throw it out there just to see how people respond. And since that time, we've actually been finding other areas of discussion that raise the same issues. So mindfulness has now become a fad in the workplace. And one of the things about mindfulness is that it's taught to increase resilience. And one of the ways it does it is there's a thing in Buddhism known as two arrows, right? You have a problem. That's arrow one, gives you pain. The second one is how you respond to the problem. and the stories we tell about ourselves and about what's going on and the victim theories and our ruminations that are unproductive are actually do more damage to us than the original arrow. And it means being able to stand inside and outside yourself, realizing the stories you're telling about yourself are not necessarily real. And that's what irony does. It allows you to say, this is my story, but maybe there are other stories out there, and maybe that traps me in certain ways. And so you could poke fun at the vision of the company, but still realize that actually the vision's got some elements in it that you rather like, but the way it's packaged is commercialized and really silly. So it's playing that balance that the ironic manager is able to do, I think.
Richard, as we talk around this, I'm thinking that this stuff is actually quite hard to teach. Now, I know that that's kind of what you do, but what I'm hearing is basically a manager with a set of skills and enough self-confidence and very good emotional intelligence, they can do this, and the best of them do it. But not everybody's like that.
Most people can be ironic. I mean, most people do have an ironic sensibility. That's what Richard and I originally called it, not the ironic manager, the ironic sensibility. And we almost thought of it as the sixth sense. The question is whether it gets encouraged or not. And of course, if you're in fear of losing your job by being critical, then you can't be this growing, interesting, fun-poking manager. My experience in teaching it is that once you get past the students going, this is a bit weird, I don't expect this in a lecture on leadership or organizational behavior, once you start pushing them to that they can poke fun at themselves, they can poke fun at the ideas, I don't really care if the ideas that I think are good, they don't think are good, as long as they can start explaining that to me and as long as they can critique it. So that's absolutely fine. But yeah, the first response is, what's this? Once you get past that, then you find that lots and lots of people are capable of poking fun a little bit and having a little bit of fun and yet be serious at the same time. So I think it is more common than we would give it credit for.
One practical example is we work with the Chris O'Brien Lifehouse at RPA with ING and now with Datacom and other companies. And we've reflected on what's been happening. It's management education as parody. Is that everybody's now kind of sick of the voice of authority that comes on and knows everything and acts like everything's correct. And we use organizational theater as a way of surfacing the fact that in most organizations there's a formal managerial story. Then there's a subordinate story about what's going on, but normally they don't get confronted. And the organization, because they don't confront the two stories and put them together, are often left in conflict and not knowing what's going on. So what we do in organizational theater is you play act the stories that everybody in the organization knows is the formal management one and the one behind the scenes. You put it in, show the destructive consequences, and then everybody in the audience is allowed to then get themselves involved and participate in re-scripting. So what it does is it shows the fact that there are just different stories going on. What happens when you confront them, and what happens when you say those are just different stories? How do we actually create a better story that's more involving, more engaging? That's the way to do it, we think.
So does your work and approach resonate across cultures, or are some cultures, some companies more up for this?
The common idea is that the Americans will be the ones that would reject this, and the Americans will say, no, we're not going to take irony seriously in the workplace. But that doesn't seem to be the case. I mean, I've had a lot of interest. I was interviewed by a big American magazine in Silicon Valley about this very thing. And the argument was, well, Americans are so earnest. Why are we so earnest at work? And my response is, Americans are brilliant at getting irony. All of the best TV shows in the world related to irony are American. You've got The Daily Show, you've got John Oliver's show, you've got The Simpsons, you've got South Park, you've got American Dad. All of these kind of shows are American. They get irony because they take things so seriously. So if you're really, really taking things seriously and you're really earnest about something and then someone comes in and starts poking fun, you move into that ironic frame and you go, oh God, yeah, I'm being an idiot. I can't believe I've done that. And you start seeing things from different perspectives. The British and perhaps Australian reaction is that we're a little bit more cynical and a little bit more used to irony in an everyday environment. it doesn't have the same power anymore. If you look at British TV shows, all of the great ironic ones, the Pythons and Spinning Image, they don't have that anymore. It's all gone to the States. So irony works really well when you've got a culture that takes itself really seriously, but is willing to start listening to other voices. When you've got a culture that sort of no longer believes it's the best, everybody's being ironic anyway, and you don't actually make a massive difference by surfacing it because nobody believes in anything too hard in the first place.
Just to continue on that theme, the one argument was made that the British were ironic because of the collapse of the empire. Is that, and if you look back in the post-war period, a lot of it was all about the silly nose toff and all the rest of it. Was the loss of the empire shatters the ambition and the confidence of the country, so you get a lot of irony. And at that stage, America wasn't known for irony. Now, as America's gone through more problems with its empire, suddenly irony is emerging in America. So it's an interesting
thing. It is. Gentlemen, it's been fascinating. Thank you very much for joining
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Richard Badham's Professor of Management at the Macquarie Graduate School of Management. Richard Clayden lectures at APIC, the Asia Pacific International College. Their consultancy is called The Ironic Manager. And if you want to find out more, follow the link on the Best Practice homepage at abc.net.au/rn. On RN Summer, I'm Richard Adey. This is Best Practice. Last year, RN advertised for a couple of digitally focused multimedia journalists. For young people interested in the media, it was an attractive opportunity and a lot applied. Every single one of those applications was read by RN's online editor, Alex McClintock, who not only found the right candidates, but along the way saw which applications worked and which didn't. So Alex, it was a big job. Let's start with the cover letter. What were your impressions?
I found that the majority of the cover letters I got were shocking. I think what you want in a cover letter is someone to tell you a bit about themselves and to show you that they get what the job is and why they would fit it. That's the pitch, and it should be about a page long.
That seems so self-evident as to be unremarkable. What were you getting?
The vast majority were basically just a CV in prose. They were just a laundry list of everything that the person had done.
So you had two copies of their CV, just one in prose and one in dot points, more or less.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. And these are from people who want to be multimedia journalists. So they should really have good communication skills.
Yeah. And I actually found the same thing with, we set a task later in the application process. And I found that people were really bad at keeping to the word limit. So being able to communicate in brief and that, again, their communication skills weren't that good. They couldn't tell me exactly what they wanted to do.
All right. So the CV, you obviously looked at a lot. What did you find there?
In terms of CVs, what I found was that so many of them are so over-designed. I think maybe because it's never been easier to do some basic graphic design on your own using programs like Canva or InDesign if you have the skills yourself.
You're not limited to Word anymore, right?
No, you're not limited to Word. So you're not having like a plain text kind of CV. You're looking at colors, like fancy formatting. And I think to a certain extent that can be really good. It can make you stand out. But I just found that, you know, with bright colors, weird formatting into columns, there's a point where it becomes distracting.
So there's too many people did too much of that.
The best example I saw of that was an applicant who their CV looked like a kind of marketing presentation, basically. It was about 6 pages long, alternating between landscape and portrait.
Right.
With, you know, fancy colors and designs on it. And at one point, there was a pie chart of how they spent each day. But the really worrying thing for me was to see that they only listed about 15% of their day as sleeping.
All right. So what there has clearly been, with the easy availability of these tools and people with the skills to use them, we now have kind of design inflation. We have kind of design competition going on.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. So you think, how am I going to make my CV stand out when everyone else is doing this? So you go absolutely buck wild.
Any other trends?
The other thing that I saw heaps and heaps of was people rating their own skills on a 5 or a 10-star system. So you've got your CV, your over-designed CV.
Yeah.
And you might have a central column that has what you would traditionally have in a CV, your employment history, your educational qualifications. And then down the right or the left-hand side, you'll have a bar where you've got each of these skills. And these might be proficiencies with certain software,
mm-hmm.
you know, say Adobe Photoshop, Adobe InDesign, Final Cut Pro. But it also might be more nebulous skills like communication, or I even saw intercultural communication.
Intercultural communication. How many stars were they getting for that?
Nobody rates themselves less than 4 stars.
I was going to say, you're never going to see a 1 or a 2, are you? If you're going to put it out there, it's always 4. And that's when you're, and that's because you feel you're holding back a bit. Really, because yeah. really you're a solid 5.
But for me, looking at this, especially when you've got skills in complex programs, when you're giving yourself 5 stars in everything, I just don't believe you. You can't be a 5-star Photoshop user and also be a 5-star video editor and also be a 5-star graphic design person, because those are all full-time jobs. There's not enough hours in a human lifetime to learn all those skills to a 5-star level.
All right. So if you're listening now and you applied for one of these jobs and you did not get it because there were 2 positions and there were 263 of you, this may be where you went wrong, the being 5-star at everything. But as we've heard, there are other ways in which you could go wrong. Headshots as well, Alex, I'm hearing. Lots of headshots.
Yeah, the headshot is back. Oh, I don't know. Maybe it never went out of fashion. But yeah, lots and lots of headshots. And I also find that a bit strange because I don't know what kind of advantage you're looking for when you attach a headshot.
But you're like, I'm incredibly hot and I have all these 5-star skills. No?
Well, I don't know. What can I say?
All right. Okay. Can we talk about the jobs themselves? You've already briefly described them. So they're multimedia journalist jobs. Could we call them entry level or what?
I would say that they're maybe a little bit past entry level because they do require a range of skills, but they're definitely an early career job.
Because we don't have a lot of entry points for young people into the ABC, they would probably be the first job for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think so. Or a lot of people who have come in from a work experience background or an internship background, people who've been working, I guess, on the fringes of the media, not so much in the paid mainstream media, but people who've, say, been at community radio or freelancing. Even the resumes that I saw from people who had been in the industry for a while, everyone starts in unpaid work. And I think this is another thing where it's a real arms race. When everybody else has what looks like this amazing experience, even if it's unpaid, how can you not do that if you want to get a job in the industry? I think this is where we get back to the cover letter and why that's important, because that's a place where you can make a statement about yourself and make a pitch for yourself being able to do the job independent of what your CV says. And I think you have a much better chance if you can write a good cover letter.
What sort of educational attainments did they have?
We were seeing really high levels of educational attainment. I would say that a bachelor's degree was the minimum. I would say most people had a bachelor's degree, most of them in media communications, with probably a decent chunk in arts as well. But then you were also looking at a lot of people who had done more than one bachelor's degree or had done master's degrees.
So what does a good application look like?
A good application to me on paper looks like a 1-page cover letter that does all those things I told you about, that tells you a bit about the person and shows a bit of personality, hopefully, describes their understanding of the role and what they can bring to the corporation. And it's probably a 1 or 2-page CV. I don't want to look at a laundry list of everything you've ever done. I don't want 8 dot points beneath each role you've done for all the individual responsibilities. I want to know about the best stuff you've done.
And not too many colors or 5-star ratings.
That's right.
Any other conclusions you came to over the course of poring over 263 applications?
I was actually really heartened because despite everything that I've said here, the issues that we had, in the end, when we got down to a short list, which was actually quite a long short list, the quality of the applicants was so good in terms of what they could actually do and their experience and their understanding of the ABC and the kind of journalism they wanted to do. It was really heartening. And it ended up being quite an affirming process, despite the big whinge that I've just had.
Alex, thank you very much for joining me today.
Anytime.
Alex McClintock, our online editor here at RN. That's it for Best Practice. Thanks to producer Ian Koo, sound engineer Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Richard Adie.